So if you want to think, you will think, and you will think true if you do not encourage yourself in the sordid luxury of thinking badly. If you settle down quietly to eliminating these things which are not thought, but which can tantalize, irritate, and destroy thought processes, you will end with a very gentle, wise attitude. This is your Zen formula, very simple. It is that you will think right when you stop thinking wrong. This is easier because it is difficult for us to understand how to think right. We don't know what right is, really. But we all know that we've gotten into trouble thinking the way we do. This is factual. Therefore, our first job is to stop doing the kind of thinking that we know gets us into trouble. As we gradually recover from this group of bad habits, we observe that in the place of the wrong thinking, better thinking comes. We cannot be dishonest inside and think straight. So we discover as we go along through life that we are subject to a series of attitudes which destroy philosophic insight. Because of these attitudes, we never can get two and two to make four, no matter how hard we try. Because somewhere between the two and the other two is imposed a hatred, a fear, a doubt, a prejudice, a false or unreasonable allegiance, an antagonism. And as a result of that, our thinking is bound to go bad. The individual who is an atheist writes a book on atheism. It is of profound interest to other atheists and to no one else, because he has written from a position in which he is no longer able to think straight. He is only able to think such thoughts as atheism will permit to arise in his own mind. He has made atheism the keeper of his mind. Therefore, it will never testify against itself. But had he taken the opposite viewpoint, the same mind would have served him just as enthusiastically. It is his own position in the pattern. So if we want to start thinking reasonably straight, we just simply stop thinking in ways that are not straight. And we point out that this isn't easy because of the continuing pressure of circumstances. But we still have to do it if we want to make philosophy our journey in life. Philosophy is searching forever to find honesty. And to a measure, this thinking straight is this search for honesty. The great abode of honesty is nature. All of nature's processes are essentially honest. The great abode of dishonesty is man, inasmuch as man is the creature who has developed a series of faculties which enable him to defy nature and go into conflict with it. So man can sell man a bill of goods, but man can never sell it to nature. Nature continues to be itself and to perform its own works in a complete and dedicated honesty. To make, then, philosophy a vital force in a life without going into systems of philosophy, the main point is to realize that there is actually no system of philosophy. What we call systems are simply outstanding exponents of certain general convictions about truth. And some of these exponents undoubtedly were better informed than others. Some of these exponents will appeal more to us than others. And some of them have a longer life in time than others. Now, there are many philosophers who flourished 300 years ago whose ideas and opinions would have been of very little value to us in the last 25 years. They belong so completely to a time, to a system, to a concept, that as that time, system, and concept perished in limbo, their significance as thinkers ceased also. There are miles of books in the great museum libraries of the world that will never be read again. because no one is concerned with their contents. What little truth might be in them is so drowned in words that it is easier to search elsewhere. There are other philosophers who, having greater insight, have gradually been justified by time. And so out of the past, we recognize those whose appeal to our day will be very limited, or who have only certain special contributions to make. We also recognize there were some to whom perhaps we are just beginning to come into understanding. They have already lived long before, but their thoughts still transcend the present and go into the future. So we look around us to find the kind of thoughts around which to build a way of life. We use the thoughts of these people to the degree that they are helpful, but we do not need to feel that we must cling to their boundaries or their syllogisms or their dichotomies and things of this nature, because we are going to move gradually out of these arbitrary concepts. We do have two great schools of philosophy, East and West. Both of these schools represent man's conditioned reaction to unconditioned values. And as man changes, his reactions will be different. But the values will be ever the same. Values do not change. It is only man's ability to accept, use, and interpret values that change, that changes. So that man today will take the same principles, but he will find a contemporary usage, or will restate them in other words, sometimes fortunate, often unfortunate. But we do have certain concepts which we call philosophical that do endure and that do continue to be meaningful, but only meaningful if we can get them inside of our own consciousness, get them in where they will start to work, rather than merely to regard them like great scenery or the marvelous antiques of a gallery, as something to be seen and to be left behind. In searching, then, for these contemporary things, we know what philosophy can do or must do if it is to make a contribution to our way of life. We are past that golden age of the philosophy of the child heart and the child mind. We are past those simple days when philosophy was very largely an application to the most common incidents of human existence. We have come into a highly involved, highly complicated civilization in which every common sense fact and principle is deeply and cunningly concealed. Thus, we have a different kind of world, but our problem remains the same. We all know today that our problem is essentially an ethical one. And ethics is one of the branches of philosophy. Thus, our great need, philosophically speaking today, is ethics. And how are we going to get this new foundation in ethical conviction? The first thing that philosophy points out is that a need always bespeaks a lack of something. When we get in a position where our cause becomes desperate, it is because we need something that we do not have. Or perhaps, by reverse, that we have something that we do not need. But actually, the primary point is that we are in need. Every individual in an emergency is a person in need. He may have money in the bank, but he is still in need. Consequently, an emergency can only be finally solved by the meeting of the need which caused that emergency. So we look around us and we say, what do we need? 99% of people believe that they need happiness. They don't have it. or they do not have it with any sense of security. Another group feel that they need peace of mind. Another that they need peace of soul. Still another group feels that they need health. Many people feel that they need sympathy, they need understanding, they need friendship. They need the confidence of other people. They need to increase their own confidence. Some feel a pressing need for increased earning power. Some need relief from sickness. Others need relief from the tangled circumstances of their own mistakes. But everyone is more or less in need. When that need becomes generally manifest, then that which is needed becomes most generally necessary. If there is then a common need, there is a great common answer that is most necessary. All the things that we indicate that we need today, all of these exist because of the lack of adequate internal integration. All the things that we really need to make ourselves happy must now, as always, come out of ourselves. Nothing imposed upon us can solve any of these problems. Efforts have been made. I know people who have complained for years that if they only had a friend, life would just be a song. Finally, the friend came along, and in a few weeks, this individual managed to transform them into an enemy. The friend didn't solve anything, because the friend was only a symbol of a need that was inside of the person. When he got a friend, he didn't even know enough to keep that friend, and lost them and added to tragedy. The individual who says, "All I need is enough to retire on," well, we know his story. He never has enough. The individual who says, "If I could only have this, I will be happy," is unhappy before it's delivered. He has a new thing that he must now have in order to make him happy. And so it goes. None of these needs can be solved simply by the shifting of the physical situations of life. All of these needs bear witness to an inadequacy within the self. There is no solution until this inadequacy is met. So how are we going to meet it? Different systems, different schools all suggest various ways. One says that the educated person can solve his problems, but the needs of the educated are as great as the needs of the uneducated. Another one says all we have to do is wait a little longer and science will meet all our needs. Well, there's a way in which it can do so by simply creating a situation in which, having become defunct, we no longer need anything. That is one answer to the problem, but not an encouraging one. Religion is supposed to help us to meet these needs. Today we have 80 million nominally religious persons in the United States, and they are on the top of the list with their needs along with everybody else. None of these institutions solve needs, because institutions cannot solve needs. The most that an institution can do is to point out to the individual how he can solve his need. It cannot solve it for him. Because every solution has to arise in an unfoldment of character. Unless this is achieved, there can be no solution. Plato, Plotinus, Buddha all held that what we now call philosophy was the science of character. That by means of philosophy, man became aware of the eternal code of existence. And that by becoming aware of this code and learning gradually to obey this code, the individual rescued himself from all need and all dilemma. that there is no other way. Evasion of this philosophic insight or philosophic growth must therefore simply result in the continuance of the need. There can be no solution to the problems around man except the solution that arises through the enlightenment that is generated within man. So philosophy stands for this enlightenment. It is the particular area of philosophy to attempt the maturing of the character of the person. This means now, how shall we attempt to mature this character? Philosophy would say that, of course, all of life should combine to make this maturing easier. All systems of knowledge should be in common agreement that the final purpose of man is the unfoldment of his own nature. What can be a more universal concept? Who can deny that all progress roots in this? Who can deny that a scientist must develop and unfold his own scientific potentials? Who can we deny that the theologian must become a greater person in order to be a greater teacher of theology? How can we deny that the worshiper must be a better person if he is to worship more wisely and conscientiously? Therefore, the development or growth of character is the most important thing that man can accomplish. And all the defects of society are revelations in nature of the defects in man, as far as human society is concerned. There can be no remedy of this society unless this remedy moves from within man. And that is why is that social revolution cannot essentially or immediately result in the improvement of the race. Social revolution is turning the barrel over and taking out the bottom instead of the top. But the same thing is in the barrel. And social revolution only assists to the degree that it contributes to human experience, and that perhaps after centuries of this struggle, we then finally accept the inevitable fact that the end of all progress is the development of human character. If this is true, and education could not deny it, although it makes little of it, why are we in this difficulty? We're in this difficulty because every institution that is necessary to enlarge and promote the advancement of character is under the control of individuals of inadequate character. Therefore, these individuals neither know what is necessary, nor would they have the courage to achieve what is necessary. Thus, the very instruments necessary for the fulfillment of our character needs are in the keepings of individuals who are unable to use these instruments for the purpose that was intended. This means that instead of being able to start at the parent's knee in the mystery of the growth of character, the individual has to start after he leaves school, because schooling will not bestow it. This perhaps is part of nature's evolutionary procedure. Thousands of years ago, when man was less mature, actually, psychically, than he is now. While we are confused today, we are confused on much bigger and better things than our ancestors were, and that means that our confusion is more perfect and more colossal. But actually, we have a greater capacity, a greater developed potential than we have ever possessed before, and that is why our mistakes are becoming increasingly dangerous. But there was a time when man was practically like an animal. And the shepherds, the priests of the temples, the old philosophical guides, the initiation and ritual systems were institutions in the physical world. They took young and promising candidates, indoctrinated them, taught them, brought them up, and made them, we might say, the custodians of their own culture. This has disappeared from our way of life. There are no longer any convenient sanctuaries where we can turn with certainty for essential enlightenment. This, however, probably is good. It simply is telling us, in our quiet way, that we're supposed to be able to take care of this ourselves by now. That the individual is given the greater opportunity and the greater inducement, the greater reward, which will result from making these decisions as a result of personal need. But we are all suffering from the same problem that children in school suffer from. A child going to school and studying with its classmates manages to maintain a certain score or average simply because of the pressure of the group around it. Take this child out of a compulsory educational system and let it try to study by itself when it pleases, and the child would get nowhere. Even the adult seldom does. It is only a great dedication that will cause the adult to stay with any program of self-improvement with the same dedication that would be evident if he was attending some institution of learning. So it is harder for the average person to discipline himself than to be disciplined by a formal structure existing around him. But in the search for value today, in the search for this necessary thing, each person has to take over the job of his own education. He has to come to the conclusion that there are these needs and that he will do something about them. If he doesn't come to this conclusion, he will drift along and die in the same needs he has now. After a while, his complaints will no longer be heard, but this is not the sign of his spiritual victory, but the victory of the mortician. This means that we go out of this life and cease to irritate others, but in all probabilities continue to irritate ourselves in the hereafter. Unless these needs are met, there is no solution. Somewhere along the line, philosophy has to move in upon each of us. Perhaps it is the rather simple idealistic philosophy of Emerson that moves in, a very gracious New England philosophy, but a philosophy that had a great deal of real value in it, because it was a philosophy of a dignified human being living a dignified existence. It was a philosophy of an individual who not only dared to be an individual, but found the experience not only a gracious one, but others around him found it also quite gracious. Here Emerson was studying Indian philosophy, yoga, Vedanta, and the Bhagavad Gita, at a time when certainly his neighbors in Concord, Massachusetts, didn't know what it was all about. They all said that Dr. Emerson was a strange one. They always referred to him as a strange one. His servants thought he was still stranger. His family was never very sure about this rather austere, tyrannical, but highly benevolent character that lived among them. He was just a strange one. But when his house burned down, the whole town got together and rebuilt it for him. They liked this strange one. He was a kind of a nice, interesting, friendly problem. He was always something to talk about. And he didn't care, and when they were talking about him, they were leaving some less fortunate soul alone. So they rebuilt his house for him. And he lived in the quiet shade of the family elms to leave a wonderful heritage of quietude, of benevolence, of mature thoughtfulness, and to really be the leader of this great Emersonian group that represented some of the finest men and women of letters that our country has ever produced. But it was a gracious kind of understanding, understanding that was built upon an acceptance of universal law and a little quiet Hinduism sifted through Unitarian theology. It was a beautiful mixture. But nobody at that time knew enough about either Hinduism or Unitarianism to know that either one was not orthodox, which was a delightful situation. And Emerson remained an enigma, just a strange one. But his strangeness has enriched our way of life immeasurably. If we could always be just a little of this graciousness and the strange one at the same time, we wouldn't have many enemies, and if our house burned down, some would probably try to help us build it again. This philosophy does not actually make people dislike us. It may make them wonder a little bit, but if we are gracious about it all, and don't parade a lot of knowledge we never attempt to apply ourselves, we will be accepted, even enjoyed, be a cherished source of conversation, and perhaps we'll leave behind a heritage of value to others. But we have to start somewhere. And to start in this philosophical journey, the Zen theory probably is about as good for Eastern or Western man as any you can think of. The beginning of philosophy, then, is to sit down and think a few simple things through. Thinking them through with the mind freed from prejudice, freed from false addictions and adherences, and from detachments and attachments both. And the individual can sit down and think very definitely something like this. What do I really need? Some people will say, well, almost everything. Perhaps we're afraid of old age. Perhaps we're afraid of poverty, afraid of pain, afraid of sickness. These different needs all come moving in upon us. But as one old gentleman said, who finally worked these needs out to his own contentment, he said, there's one thing I finally decided after 10 years of suffering. Namely, that no one is going to starve to death in a welfare state, so we can relax on that one. Now, there are things like this that then can burst through. They're very homely things. But they may take our minds from problems that are not really very solvable and put them onto problems that are solvable. 9/10 of people who, after 70 or 65, have a lot of trouble getting along are people who were a little difficult to get along with before they were 65 and 70. The root of the problem goes back. Lonely people are, for the most part, people who have never had the knack or the understanding to build strong relationships with life. And as various conditions shift around, these people find themselves more and more isolated. But this isolation is due to character and not to circumstance in the majority of instances. These things can be controlled and directed and thought through if we want to. And when we get to thinking things through, we get to be philosophers. When we also add to the thinking through of things the resolution to find an answer to the problem of its immediate need, then we begin to understand values. We need all kinds of things, but all of this need springs from a primary need, and that is the need for personal insight. Personal understanding, the wealth of personal consciousness. This is underneath it all. So we begin to examine ourselves as to how this need, this great need, is operating. The individual who has no aesthetic life, who cannot appreciate a good book, who doesn't know a picture from a scrawl, who has never read a book of poetry because, as Goethe says, he doesn't like verse that jogs and jiggles. People who have none of these values then turn around and say they're bored. They're bored because they have no sense of the development of appreciation for value. Then there are people with nothing to do, surrounded by a world of things that need to be done. These people simply have not reached out and come to valuable conclusions about their own abilities and the things they can do. There is always something wrong in the thinking of the person in whose life something is wrong. We're all going to be that way. This isn't in any way a reflection upon anyone. We're all going to pass out of here in need of something. But we don't need to need quite as much as we do. There are some common needs we could take care of. And we think of these needs only in terms of poverty. But the great poverty is poverty of consciousness. And when we are poor in consciousness, we are poor indeed. And most of us are poor in consciousness because we are poor in our deeds. We haven't gotten out and done things that needed doing. Getting down to our quietude and trying to think the thing through philosophically, we have to come, ultimately, to certain recommendations about our own conduct. If we do not, then we have simply been lying to ourselves. But if we have tried sincerely to be honest, we know there are things we are doing poorly that we should be doing better. Now, philosophy has to give us the incentive to do these things better. It has to do so because it is reasonable. Because philosophy moves the entire process of life from accident to purpose. Nothing remains left to chance anymore. And having luck removed from our way of life, we have to substitute merit. There is nothing left. So we move gradually on the merit system. We come to the conclusion that whatever we want, we must work for. And that whatever achievement we attain must result from an appropriate amount of effort directly imposed upon this project. If, for example, we say to ourselves, I would like to look forward to the last 20 years of my life being happy, well-adjusted, useful, cheerful, reasonably helpful years. This is a big thing to ask for. We're asking for much more than $1 million, because $1 million cannot produce one of those factors. We're asking much more than fame or high office. We're asking about all that is good in life and all that life a value can bestow upon us. We are asking to be able to draw out of the bank the most valuable resources on earth. Therefore, we have to make some kind of a budget plan or something to get these resources. When we're buying a home, we go in debt and we pay and pay and pay for 15 or 20 years, and by the time we get it paid for, it's fallen apart. But we think nothing of this. We're buying a home. This is a noble experiment, a noble purpose. We may die before it's paid for also, but we're still buying a home, somebody's home, or for somebody. We don't know just who. But we don't think anything of going without a lot of luxuries month after month in order to make that payment in which the first 10 years is mostly interest. How do we expect, then, to build a character without some effort to set up a system of payment? If we are willing to work hard in order to earn enough, to spend enough, to keep ourselves comfortable, how do we have to prepare to keep ourselves wise? A lot of people believe that they're born wise. The only difficulty is they're never able to prove it. Actually, we are born with the potential of building these securities we need. But if we just don't do anything about them, we will never have them. An individual who doesn't build a career may drift through 20 jobs until he reaches an age when he's no longer employable, and then he sits down and begins to wonder what happened to him. Same is true in the problem of character. An individual doing nothing with character, doing nothing to build it, drifts along until he gets himself into such a horrible problem by his own compromising and his own ignorance that there's just no way out. He is completely floored. He has never built anything, therefore he never has anything. So character begins wherever we discover we need it, and begins by setting up a regime in us which we have to live with every day. And if we work at character as hard as we work at profits, we will end up with the profits of character. This doesn't mean we neglect the other, because fortunately they do not actually conflict. No one says a good businessman has to have a vile temper. No one says that a good mother has to be a gossip. These do not conflict. Character is the building of an inner life that parallels the development of our outer life, and perhaps should lead it and inspire it. But if we want to have this happy last 20 years of life, we have to build for it. We have to start in as soon as we can. It wouldn't be too late if we started at near the end. It wouldn't be too soon if we started the day we were born. But whenever we do start, we have to work with it as assiduously as possible, giving constant, constructive, kindly, happy thought to the building of this destiny that we want. And we have to do it by enriching friendships, by building the faith of other people, by bringing into the lives of our children values so real that those children become very closely and deeply attached to us, by natural and proper attachments and not by the forceful attachments of duty and discipline. We have to maintain a certain equity in our spending, in our saving, in order that we may have reasonable probability of attaining the end that we want. We have to also increase the insight of our inner lives, so that as our physical activities become more restricted, our inner life takes over, and instead of aloneness being lonely, aloneness is a magnificent adventure in the use of the stored up inner consciousness which we have been accumulating through the years. Now, some will say this is a pipe dream, but there are people who do it, and these people win. The one who doesn't win is the person who doesn't do it. So you can start at any point to begin to plan a reasonable life. And the planning of a reasonable life is the highest form of philosophy. And all that philosophy in all its academic measures can possibly provide is some help, some incentives, some enlightenments, some rules and regulations by means of which some of these things can be estimated more correctly. And most of the world's greater thinkers in philosophy have been more or less thinkers who have mingled schools of philosophy according to their own needs, forming a kind of eclecticism, a philosophy that has been called a poor man's philosophy, but one which in reality has a lot of good thoughts in it. Let's, for example, say an individual wants to know how he should conduct himself. How should you act? Well, Immanuel Kant's categorical imperative still remains as one of the best definitions of that. If you want to know how you should act, all you have to say, if the way I conduct myself became a universal procedure and everyone acted the same way, would this constitute the greatest good for all? Well, that's a good question. In fact, many people feel that it is a far truer and greater statement than the Golden Rule. Because people may not want you to do to them what they are doing to you. That's quite not necessarily a good practical notion. But if the way you acted became the code by which everyone acted, would you be happy in the system? If your conduct returned to you from everyone you knew, would you say, my, what a nice lot of people? Or would you say to yourself, I hope I never see them again? If you carry just a little story to someone else, would you like everyone in the world to be carrying stories about you to everyone else? Would you want to have that kind of thing the way of life? If you nag a little more than is necessary, would you like to live in a world in which the echo of nagging is never missing from the hills? Would you like to live where everything is echoing and re-echoing one nag after another? If you are trying to get along at someone else's expense, would you like the whole world to be trying to get along at your expense? If you don't care for somebody and you're living with them only because it's profitable, would you like all the world to do the same thing and maybe do it to you? These are questions. And I think Kant has a rather good answer. Now, that's the way philosophy can sneak into a situation and give you a little help. Schools of philosophy can say to you, here are rules. If you think these rules through, you'll probably do fairly well. Therefore, we can go to another's problem of life, and we can say, according to philosophy, what is the highest virtue that a person can practice? And Socrates answers that question by saying that the highest virtue that a man can practice is to be himself, to be his real self. Now, if you say to yourself, well, if I practiced being myself, there wouldn't be much virtue in it. That tells you the answer. That unless you can be yourself and at the same time be the best person you can think of, if in being yourself you are less than virtue, then you have not cultivated the greater virtue. Now, someone else will say, if I'm supposed to change my habits, which habits should I change first? Pythagoras says, change first that habit, the changing of which will change all other habits. In other words, you can start cutting one leaf off the tree at a time, or perhaps you can try to become a more moral person by the famous procedure that was used in bobbing the cat's tail, cutting off a little at a time so it would hurt less. This procedure is what most of us try to do. We say, well, I'll get good by degrees because if I go too fast, it's going to hurt too much. So in that way, no good is ever done. But if we have to correct some vice in our nature, what vice should we correct? By the correction of which we will correct most other vices. Buddha answered, selfishness. If you can get rid of that, you can get rid of most everything. If you get rid of selfishness, most of the problems that betray us most frequently fall away. If you are not selfish, you do not wish advantage at the expense of others. This in itself relieves us of most of the conspiracies which burden life, most of the falseness of life, most bad marriages, most poor business relationships, most unfair friendships arise from secret selfishness. An individual trying desperately to be happy is secretly very selfish. Now, some people are selfish physically, some mentally, some emotionally. But if you can weed out selfishness, you probably can come the nearest to reducing the general stock of troubles within your own nature. With the end of selfishness comes the end of opinionism, this desperate struggle to be always right, which is almost certain to end in common misery. With the end of selfishness comes also freedom from this desperate effort to possess, whether it be persons or things. And the unselfish individual gradually finds all other tensions are reduced. He is then left with only one real problem: how to be intelligently unselfish. This is the surviving difficulty. But it is better to face this than it is to face the compound felonies resulting from selfishness. So if you want to dig out one basic characteristic which has probably contributed more misery to you than anything else in all your life, go to work on selfishness. You'll find that selfishness is not easy to uproot. Its roots are deep, and its tap roots go down to the deepest part of our ambitions. But until we get rid of it, we will never be able to hope for peace. Now, another problem that arises is, if all these things are true, and I have to work on this problem so desperately and so constantly, for it seems it's all like swimming against a stream. I feel like being selfish, I'm told I mustn't. I feel like disliking someone, I'm told I can't. I feel like I want something, I'm told I shouldn't want it. This all gets a battle between the instincts that we naturally desire to express and a code that is imposed upon us which we do not like. It's like saving. There's no particular fun in it unless we're misers. But we have to sometimes in order to achieve those ends which only thrift can accomplish. So always, instead of thinking of our being frustrated, we have to think in terms of some greater thing we want that is more important than the small things for which we are sacrificing character. But now comes the simple problem of where is the balm in Gilead? What salve are we going to use on these bruises and aches and pains that result from the process of trying to be good? Because it is, to most people, a rather painful procedure. So we try to find in philosophy now the formula of how to be good without too much misery or too much assumed pain in the process. And philosophy, again, tells us very, very simply that there is no pain in being good. That if what we call pain in being good, as Lao Tzu, the great Chinese mystic philosopher, points out, is simply the pain of being yourself in the presence of a world that is going in an opposite direction. Actually, you're not penalized for being good. You penalize yourself by looking around you and saying, look at all these people doing what they want to do. And because I'm a philosopher, I can't do it. It's a perfectly desolating state of affairs. But if you're a philosopher, just wait a minute and see what is happening to these people who are doing the things that philosophy is trying to get you not to do. You say, my goodness, look at that man. He has that beautiful new car. He must have paid $5,000 for it, and I'm supposed not to covet it. I'm supposed to look placidly at this man and say, I'm glad you have it. And even as I'm saying it, I say to myself, I am a liar. I'm not glad he has it, because in my heart and soul, I know I'm the one who should have had it. Only he had the money. So this is the situation. But if, instead of building this situation, which causes pain, we simply relax and watch this world of people doing the thing that we feel philosophy is trying to prevent us from doing. I've watched this a long time, and I've seen what happens. I've seen the equivalent of the man with the new expensive car. And I've gone by that house later and seen the black wreath on the door. This man with the new car, the expensive home and everything, dropped dead one afternoon in his office. This is what we've been deprived of, not the car. We have faced the horrible misfortune of not being able to drop dead at 47. because his way of life that resulted in this particular pattern, which to us seems so wonderful, was the way of life that destroyed him. For many years, an individual lived in continuous envy of a very wonderful family living next to them. This family must have been a family of great means, because servants did everything. And the lady of the house was only seen flittingly, moving from one magnificent room to another. Everything was very solemn, very snobbish, very set apart from everyone else, and the neighbors were just one mass of gossip. Here was an individual that must certainly be living the life of a royal princess. When the truth finally came out, the woman of that house was a hopeless alcoholic who was in delirium tremens most of the time and finally committed suicide. The reason she never came out was the fact that she couldn't walk straight. And all the envy went up in bubbles. It is the same with everything. We look out at these things, and then philosophy says, don't envy this one frame of a large picture. Look the picture through. You will then see that the only individual to whom you can direct envy is the man of character. He is the only one who, in the end, will come to anything worth envying. And that person you can be. That all these little things that seem to be so worthwhile that we hate to give them up are actually the very things that are giving us our heartaches. That therefore we're not losing anything. It's no problem of regret. It's a problem of getting our minds onto a different level of value in which that is regarded as worth emulating, which itself is the greatest good. Because it is only in that way that we can solve things. Now, it's nice enough to try to be acceptable by everyone else. It's wonderful to try to be regarded as a popular member of the community. It's wonderful to be in fashion and be in style and be, as they say today, on the top of the heap. But when you make all these sacrifices to the insanity of the time, and then something goes wrong with you, who cares? Who is going to come forward and say, well, you tried to be one with us. You made a splendid showing in doing the things we all do. Therefore, now in your emergency, we'll all get together and get you out of it. Do they ever say that? No. They only simply say, poor old Joe, it served him right. He drank too much. Of course, we made him do it, but he let us make him do it. Now he's gone. It's his own fault. He shouldn't have drank. So the rest keep right on going, doing their own way. The company gets a new sales manager, and everything goes on as before. The sales force makes an alcoholic out of the manager and then replaces him. This is the reward we get for being one of the good sports. Nothing. But we try our best to be like everybody else, and our only reward is that we are just like them. And what happens to them, we find out when we read the morning paper. So philosophy says, think this through. Use common sense, think all these things through. Philosophy gives you the power to sit down and think things through. And when you do this, you're not going to say philosophy is a burden on the spirit. You're not going to say it keeps me from doing the things I want to do. Rather, we are going to suddenly realize that it is a very delightful and helpful friend. Someone who really has our good at heart. Because wisdom has the good of all things at heart, and at mind also. And that all it's doing is asking us not to do the things which create the great need, the misery, the sorrow, with which otherwise we will be suddenly faced as a result of a careless attitude toward life. So I think that in this sense, philosophy can help us now, not as a system of jarring beliefs that will never be reconciled, but as an approach to life, an organized thoughtfulness by which we think all things through, weigh all things with the faculties that have been given to us, and cling joyously but firmly to that which is good, in so doing relieving ourselves of most of the disasters which might normally make our lives miserable. If we can get some of this thinking done, I think it will help us in this time, in this critical time, to face living. Well, it's also a critical time to go home, so I better stop. I will see you next week.